Welcome back to Scoreheads, the podcast that celebrates the music of your favourite films, TV shows and video games by going behind the scenes of the composing industry and having in-depth conversations with those that make the notes that emote. I'm John Brown, and for this latest episode, we're taking a walk back to an illuminating interview that Sean Wilson and I conducted with the entirely brilliant composer John Powell, who returns to both our radio show The Composer Series and this very podcast, following on from his chat about migration earlier last year. Joining him is an incredible treat in the form of iconic songwriter and lyricist for songs of the stage and screen, the masterful Mr. Stephen Schwartz, and both discussing the music of the feverishly popular and hugely successful film adaptation of Wicked. The interview, originally broadcast back in November on ExpressFM, in line with the film's theatrical release, was, we're very happy to say, well received. And now, for the first time, and to celebrate the home release of the film this weekend, you can hear it completely uncut in its full form here on the Scoreheads podcast. Which brings us to the stars of this week's show, both absolutely brilliant, both with a long history of creating game-changing music and lyrics between them that span across the worlds of film, theatre, TV and beyond. Stephen Schwartz is a multi-award-winning titan of the musical stage and screen in his role as a famed musical theatre and musical film composer and lyricist, who's written such hit musicals as Godspell, Pippin and, of course, Wicked. He's also contributed lyrics for a number of successful films, including Pocahontas, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, The Prince of Egypt, and Enchanted, and recently adapted his celebrated work on Wicked for the silver screen with our next guest. Our second guest, John Powell, is a returning guest and, as I just mentioned, has worked with Stephen on both the score for Wicked and in the late 90s as part of Hans Zimmer's team on the soundtrack to DreamWorks' first huge animated theatrical release, The Prince of Egypt. Since then, of course, and between both The Prince of Egypt and Wicked, he's composed music for some huge films, both animated and live action, including creating sensational music for Ants, Chicken Run and Shrek with Harry Gregson-Williams, Face Off, the Jason Bourne films, Robots, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, X-Men The Last Stand, the Ice Age movies, Happy Feet 1 and 2, the How to Train Your Dragon films, Star Wars A Solo Story and many, many more. Together, they make a phenomenal creative team, as evidenced by the recent aforementioned collaboration on director John M. Chu's box office smashing cinematic retelling of hit Broadway show Wicked, and Sean Wilson and I are very pleased that they could share their time with us and you on the podcast this week. Their names are Stephen Schwartz and John Powell, and they join Sean and I on this, your latest episode of Scoreheads.
The best way to bring folks together
something has changed within
is to give them a real good enemy.
You're green.
I am.
Something is not the same.
Something just takes over me. And when it does, bad things happen.
Once you learn to harness your emotions, sky's the limit.
Bring her to me.
Don't be afraid.
I'm not afraid. It's the wizard who should be afraid of me.
And it is an incredible pleasure now to welcome onto the show two artists who it is more than fair to say are the masters of their craft. For the third time on this show, we're pleased to welcome back the brilliant composer John Powell. And for the very first time on the show, Sean and I are very excited to welcome composer and lyricist Stephen Schwartz, thus proving that there are indeed miracles when you believe. Welcome, chaps. How are you?
Hi. Thank you for that little side reference there, that little Easter egg, or Passover egg, I suppose.
Yes. More on that shortly. Yeah, thank you both for coming on. And you're back working together again for the soundtrack to the excellent film adaptation of Wicked, which was sensational. We'll get into that shortly. I say again, because this isn't
technically your first radio together, is it? If I'm not mistaken, you worked together on The Prince of Egypt. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
Yeah.
And tell us a little about your memory, for as a jumping off point, and because it is one of my favourite films of all time, what were your memories of working together on that and of your experience both creating music and your part in that particular film?
John, you want to go ahead?
Well, it'll be interesting because it's so long ago, we probably have slightly diverse memories of it. All I remember is it's the first thing I ever did when I got to Hollywood. Hans had sort of said, oh, you should come out, because I was working with him in London on some things. You should come out. And I didn't come out for about 9 months, I mean, which was sort of a madness. But I decided I needed to do some other things. And when I arrived, he kind of looked at me and said, like, looked at me like, who the are you? So I then thought, oh no, I've made a terrible mistake. And he said, and he was like, oh, there's this thing I'm supposed to be doing, which is doing, you know, helping with the songs on Prince of Egypt. And so he showed me Deliver Us, the opening, and I was like, holy this is incredible. Mm. And then I think I, in a way, kind of got palmed off on Stephen a bit. You know, it's like, okay, well, he'd done the big opening number, and it's like there were all these other numbers to do. So I was amazed that I was immediately then thrust into this thing with Stephen, who was very gracious, considering it's like, literally, who the was I? I was some kid doing it. And so we then sort of progressed through, I think, quite a few of the songs. We had a look at quite a few of the songs, really. And it was wonderful. And it was literally the first time I'd done anything with animation. And with Stephen, and that's a great way to arrive in Hollywood, I think.
Hans Zimmer had come on to help just get all the music together for DreamWorks, because they were a brand new animation studio. DreamWorks had just been created by Steven Spielberg and Jeffrey Katzenberg and David Geffen, and one of their very first things out of the gate was Prince of Egypt. And so Hans, who had very good and long experience with Jeffrey Katzenberg and particularly working on Lion King, came on board to help organize the music, work on the score, help arrange the songs, give it kind of an authentic Middle Eastern sound, etc. And he had two relatively new people working with him in the studio, John Powell and Harry Gregson-Williams, both of whom have gone on to great glory, as you know, on their own. But for whatever reason, I just particularly hit it off personally with John, shared sort of a similar musical sensibility and just way of working. So then, lo, those many, many moons later, when it was time to find somebody to do the scoring of Wicked, you know, work with me on that and do the heavy lifting, frankly, on the score part of the soundtrack. John was absolutely my first choice. By then, of course, he'd become quite starry. So it's a question of whether he would be available and we could get him. But fortunately, he made himself available, kind of barely at first, but ultimately to a great extent.
I'm very glad it's you, John, because we've had many conversations before where there's that thing in Hollywood where they say, if it flies, get John Powell to do it. And I'm really pleased, because when I saw it was announced, I was like, I hope it's John Powell, because it just feels like that would be a great fit. So I'm glad it's you.
Well, I have another story, which John knows, because we knew that if it flies, get John Powell. But when we were considering whom to bring on, and I was already very much in favor of John, but I happened to be taking a plane over to London, and I watched a movie on the plane called Don't Worry, Darling, which is kind of a thriller, very small, intimate movie, not epic at all. And I'm listening to the score for this movie, which is very, very subtle and creepy. And I'm thinking, I don't even quite know how the composer of the score actually did this, gave this mood to this movie with like these long sustained notes, and it's very subtle and nuanced. And so I thought, this is the kind of thing I totally do not know how to do. I wonder who this is. And then, of course, it turned out to be John Powell. So by the time I got off the plane, I called Mike Knobloch and said, it absolutely has to be John Powell, because he can do all these things that I can't do at all. So, yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you both, given that there was a big gap between The Prince of Egypt and start of production on Wicked, like, how easy was it to renew that sensibility and to renew those conversations? Did you both kind of pick up where you left off? How did that work?
It was pretty, I mean, John, I'll let you speak too, but it was, it was pretty easy. It wasn't really renewing the working situation, because we were both in different places in our lives, and also John was much more actively going to be composing, you know, for this. Yeah, but I think the sort of personal ease of dealing with one another that we had found 2 decades ago came right back.
The first thing that we talked about was the fact that, you know, how does this work? I mean, if you think about it, the difficulty with anything like this is, at the moment when you start, there is no way of knowing how to do this. And then you have to figure out how to do it. So I think that was the interesting thing. I'd probably done, I think it was about 68 films since Prince of Egypt. So my head was very in, sort of, as I say, you know, through the lens, as it were. And I think Stephen sort of realized that I should be sort of pointed at that. And John Chu definitely needed that, because, you know, it was becoming a movie. It's a different thing. I mean, I think the great thing about what we did do, Stephen, is I like to think of it as this, it's a great version of what the musical was, but it's also a great movie. It's both things at the same time. It's a new piece of art. And yet, of course, it is totally from that sense of, from the experience the people had in the theatre originally since 2003, it's like the same experience, but just in this new format. And it's not just fluffed up. It's this new way. So we didn't really know how to do it. And I think that was the exciting moment for me.
John, when we first got together, confessed somewhat shamefacedly that he had not actually seen the show. And so I said, well, don't. But then please do not go to the show yet, if you're going to go at all, until you see the movie, so that you're coming to it completely through those eyes, as John says, through that lens. Ultimately, he did sneak off and see the show when he was in London. But by that time, he had seen the movie, and so he was bringing that approach to it, talking together about motifs and thematic material, what little pieces of an intro to a song or underscoring of a song that existed in the show meant something in terms of a particular character, a particular relationship, a particular emotion. And John, I feel, in the part of the score that he created, has been extremely generous about including those themes and weaving them in, so that I think there is a seamlessness to the score that you can't really tell who did what and where the score ends and the songs begin, and actually, in fact, where dialogue ends and the songs begin. And I think it's one of the things that's making the movie play so effectively for audiences.
Would that be like the more of the use of like a leitmotif, so using themes from the musical as like a leitmotif,
exactly,
fashion, like allocating to characters and so on?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just an allocation to character, you know, the sort of strict leitmotif definition. I like to write that way when I do a musical for the stage anyway. There are motifs that go through and are changed and adjusted. But in this case, because you have a vastly greater amount of scoring going on, a perfect example of this, which John chose to do, presumably with John Chu, though it seems like it might have been me, but it was actually John, is at the very, very beginning, when someone asks Glinda about her friendship with Elphaba, and as she is sort of denying it and trying to cover up the fact that it existed, what you're hearing on the soundtrack is the intro to the song For Good, which doesn't even occur in movie one. It comes in movie two. Mm. But it becomes sort of their love theme, I suppose, if you will. And that's the kind of motific work that both John and I tried to do in the film.
That piece of material, I mean, the original score that Stephen did is just packed so much with material. Yep. It was the hardest part was sort of choosing almost. And then also, you know, finding ways of developing it. I think that's mainly what I kind of did, was I took everything from tunes, motifs, a lot of this through composed, really elegantly composed work, but I had to sort of develop it. I think that's what we did. And so sometimes, you know, those tunes meant things, and other times the motifs could work on lots of different levels as well. And then there were other times when we had to sort of go, we had to leave some of that material and find new material, but it was always kind of, it was, you know, I like to think of like variations on a theme by Paganini. It's, you know, if you think of some of the versions that Rachmaninoff did, I mean, there's Retrograde and there's, you know, Inversions and things like that. And I mean, I really had kind of a lot of compositional fun with your material, Steve. I mean, some of it may be more hidden than others. Some of it's very clear, you know, when it needed to be. But other times as well, there's things that perhaps you don't quite realize are sort of, they're sort of knitted out of certain yarns and things. Mm-hmm. So I mean, but obviously the whole idea was that you never knew where the beginnings and ends of any ideas were as well. You know, it just flowed, and that was the main thing.
Were you excited, John, from the get-go? Were you ready to dive right in? Were you happy, or were you nervous because it's entirely huge? I guess in a way it's like being passed a masterpiece by a painter and saying, I need you to add to this. Did it feel like that in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, it's like if we'd been given a sketch and they say, okay, we now have to do the whole roof. Jeez. But I was excited because, to tell you the truth, one of the things is that it was the reactions of people when I said, they're talking to me about doing a Wicked, and people's faces to me would change, they would shift, and I'd suddenly get this feeling, oh, this has got a real significance. Mm. This is socially significant. And then as I discovered that, I realized that, you know, it's very hard to do a big films that are going to be joyful. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of big films that I don't do because they are, in my opinion, kind of slightly pernicious to society. There's so much just people thumping the shit out of each other in the name of entertainment. And I mean, I have done some, but I'm trying not to. So to find a really joyful project like this, I think that was one of the greatest attractions for me.
Well, it's interesting. This is the first time I've heard John say that, but I think that is one of the things he brought to the score, is this joy and exhilaration and excitement, so that, yeah, people sort of just bound out of the theater. And a lot of that has to do with the support that the work that John did gives to the storytelling of the film.
That's interesting, because I remember I interviewed you, John, many, many years ago for the website Den of Geek, and I remember you mentioned that about the whole, so many productions use chaos as like a crutch and how tiresome that can be, and to actually find a project like, you know, a project that actually has like moral value and joy and happiness in it, and clearly that's what Wicked is. I'm always really interested by suppose the expansion of taking something from a stage environment and putting it onto a cinematic canvas, because evidently theatre and cinema work in different ways, and the music works in different ways as well. Like in the film, you can get closer up into the characters' faces and you can maybe extend those emotional nuances out a bit longer. I wanted to ask you both, like, what are the complexities of that relative to the production on the stage and the production in the film?
Yeah, I mean, there are obviously, Sean, you've already said some of the things that one can do in film that you just can't do in theater. The close-up is probably the biggest advantage that one gets in film, but also you can do action sequences, and there are a lot of action sequences in Wicked because the show story was split into two films. We have the great advantage of ending a musical on an action sequence, which you never get to do. And I think it's part of the exhilaration that people are feeling at the end of this movie. On the other hand, there are moments on stage where basically a character is simply standing and singing for about 3.5 minutes and nothing else is happening. And that can be enormously exciting on stage, but it's very complicated. It's very tricky to do that on film. What's actually going to be happening with the camera and with the staging during this sort of long inner monologue that a character is singing? You know, in Wicked, there are songs like The Wizard and I and I'm Not That Girl that have that challenge to them. Even Popular has that challenge to it. And so how do you treat that musically so it doesn't feel static and also that it doesn't feel that it's sort of wedged into a motion picture? For me, because it's the songs that some of them present that challenge, that was the greatest challenge for me about adapting the score.
Yeah, I mean, it gives me a panic attack to think of how to do things that you do, Stephen, on stage with a smaller ensemble and with the efficiency that you need as well. That's one of the incredible things about musicals, is that when you look at how well when they're done really well, like this is, you know, how efficient it is. It gets through everything incredibly quickly, and the underscoring is just amazing for that. But there's moments, I was going to say, Stephen, it's like one of the reasons that the beginning of Not That Girl is sort of the way it is, because I couldn't stop. We'd been working on the cue before it, and I think I had the dialogue track up as usual, and of course Cynthia starts singing, so I sort of couldn't stop, so I kept going a little bit, and that's so rather than the song starting, it's kind of, I felt like I'll just keep scoring until we get to a point at which the song takes over. And so that's why I think that transition is the way it is, because it didn't feel like a song start. You know,
I think that's a really good example. Yeah, that when
it was
John,
to do with where the camera was and stuff like this, I think.
And when John created that and then showed it to, first of all, John Chu, who is very, very musical and has strong and usually correct instincts about how music should function. But then, you know, when they showed it to me, I just loved how we got into that song. But, you know, John is choosing this one instance, but he did this over and over in the score for the film. The way the score and song sections weave in and out of each other, for instance, in Defying Gravity, I think you're not really aware of when you are watching it, you know, that it's stitched together, because it doesn't feel that way. There's just a flow. And this was one of the things that I really valued about the collaboration with John, with both Johns, John Powell and John Chu, that it was so collaborative that there was never like turf war, if you know what I mean. It was never like, well, this is my part and that's your part. It was all trying to flow it as seamlessly as we possibly could.
Actually, that beautifully leads on to my next question. You mentioned Defying Gravity there, and I was thinking, Stephen, you've written, so have you, John, written many, many great songs. John, you've written many great themes. And I guess the question for you, Stephen, is, especially with a song like Defying Gravity, what is the secret to a great song, a great number, that catchy, emotional, impactful, unforgettable tune like Defying Gravity? What's the secret?
I think it's that it comes out of the character and the emotion. You know, I was just trying to find, when I wrote it originally for the stage, and before I even wrote the song, just thinking about the moment, what musically sounded like power coming up through the ground, through your feet and up into you. What would be that sound? Because that's what happens during Defying Gravity. It's interesting because Defying Gravity is not structured at all like a typical song, liftable song. There, it's all sorts of bits and pieces. There's a whole long scene that occurs during it, even in the show. And then in the movie, there's even more because there are all these action sequences that occur in it. And yet it all flows and feels like one song. So I think it relies very heavily on motif. You know, as Sean had said before, there's kind of orchestral motifs that aren't part of the sung tune, but unite the whole song. There's a lot of reprise material from other things that have been sung earlier in the show that find their way into it. So it's really a composition more than a song. And then when we did the movie, it's now a composition by both myself and John Powell that we did together, but has a unification that I think is resonating for people.
It was a chicken and egg one. I think we went the longest time going, okay, who goes first, as it were, you know, because that was the question, is like how to make all of this work. I mean, and it kind of got to the point where, I mean, I got really late on it because I really couldn't figure it out, I must admit. And I kept sort of waiting for you guys to go first. And I think you'd been waiting for us to try and figure it all out. And I wasn't sure if I knew how to figure it out, to tell you the truth. I mean, this is one of the things I've found, and maybe it's the same process for you when you're nearing the end of getting the project to work. It's not until, especially this last part, which was the hardest part, the pieces were not available in my brain because of until I'd sort of got John happy with the rest of the score, you know, all of these bits. And then it felt like I had the, suddenly all the bits were available. I sort of knew how the movie was working, and then I could just extend that into this reel, and we figured then out how to do it. But it's nerve-wracking because there's always these bits in films where it's the last bit of the puzzle, but it's a big puzzle because it's a whole reel and it's the most famous song and everything was kind of riding on it. It was absolutely nerve-wracking. I mean, I didn't get all of those bits quite in place, Stephen, until just before I went to London for the second time. That's the crazy.
I mean, I guess that's why I mean a composition, because the word composition also suggests composite. And the trick with a composite is not to make it look that that's what it is. One thing that John did, which I also valued, is that on some cues, which we knew ultimately he was going to do, he was going to write, he was going to score them, but I'd sort of do kind of an early version. And I think that even though a lot of times the stuff that I did was not really, didn't wind up in the movie, you know, maybe a little bit here and a little bit there, but the story, what I was trying to do from a storytelling or emotional journey point of view, did. And John was just able to use his skills and experience to do it effectively, but I always felt heard, which I didn't necessarily know was going to happen when this whole thing started.
Yeah, there's basically this wonderful time when Stephen kind of learnt Logic.
And yeah, I learned that for this movie. Yeah.
And we'd be, I mean, even he was in one of the other rooms in here, and he'd be sketching things out. And I think the great value of that is there's some bits of that, Stephen, which we are exactly as they are.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's some bits of it I even would take and put in other places. And then there was also the intention of it, I think, as well. And that's, so it just became a sort of a translation, you know, a language translation, I think, into sort of a very, and sometimes the very minimalist way that film and the lens asks for, and I, you know, and then John responds to. So it was interpretation. I think that's really what doing.
Underscoring in the theater is much busier. It just has a lot more notes, and it's a lot more overt repetition of themes and of song material. Because in some ways you want the audience to have the whatever lyrics were attached to certain songs playing in their heads while they're hearing this underscoring. In a movie, you have to be more subtle. And that was something that John knew about more than I did. But I like, John, that you just said that the intention always got carried out, because that is how I feel about the final score.
Yeah, you remember that scene where they're telling each other, the two girls are telling each other sort of secrets.
Right.
We went over that quite a few times, and John's, response always was so kind of prickly to things. He would react at absolutely just the wrong thing at the wrong, just slightly wrong chords or the right. I mean, sometimes it comes down to major minor at the wrong moment. It's themes, and other times it's motifs. It's the wrong motif, or just staying out the way, and then how you get to the end of the scene. So it was a really hard scene to do. And I mean, for instance, the front part of that is the saddest bit, I think, in the movie of music. And it's actually the middle eight from I'm Not That Girl.
I'm Not That Girl. Yeah. Exactly.
And it's this brilliant set of chords that go down and down and down. And she's telling this terrible story. It's like it was the perfect thing that you felt like somebody's sort of realization of a life that's been sort of nothing but scorn and pain. Mm-hmm. You feel this
devastation. But again, what you were able to do with that, John, was to treat it in such a way that the audience isn't singing the lyric along in their heads while they're hearing her tell it. And that was a very interesting distinction to me between how you do underscoring for a show, so that it's very subtle. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, I know it's the chords of I'm Not That Girl. And I think the audience responds to it emotionally in that way, but they don't, they're not consciously calling the song to mind as they're listening to it.
So much has been made about how Cynthia Erivo, Ariana Grande, and the actors sang live on set, and I just wanted to bring up the practicalities of that. I mean, I'm assuming that there was playback on the set to help guide their performances there. Can you guys just
sure, of course.
How that worked?
Everything was pre-recorded in terms of the vocals. They were pre-recorded to sort of tracks, MIDI tracks, not the real orchestra at all. And then with those pre-records, we figured out, what approach they were going to take to the song. If there was a specific riff that was different from the show, we sort of made those decisions. And when the vocals were pre-recorded, we were very careful to use the same mic among the mics that they used as they were using on set, so that we could go back and forth. Then when they performed, even if they were singing live, they had in-ears that mm-hmm. were giving them the track to which they had sung. So the timing was the same, the miking was the same, and we therefore would be able to go back and forth to the extent that was necessary. There were a couple of things that were done on a set where Dominic Amendum, one of our music team, just was there playing a piano for the timing, and then we would use that piano track to orchestrate too. But we cut back and forth in the soundtrack between the live performances, and occasionally there's a word, frankly, that wasn't so well sung live. And we used the whole live performance, and then we replaced that one word with the pre-record here and there. So you get the impact and the emotional immediacy of a live performance, but you get the perfection of pre-record. It was very tricky from a sound point of view to be able to match that sound. And that is really a great tribute to the sound engineers that we had on the film.
I just add that this is one of the biggest sort of teams of engineering and music edit engineering and editorial that I've ever worked on. And they're all brilliant. I mean, really, it's a huge team of people sort of doing all of this. Incredible.
Takes a village, right? Takes a Village. It's an incredible soundtrack. It's an incredible film. The movie is in cinemas and theatres right now. It's called Wicked. It's amazing. Buy the record. See the movie over and over again. Stephen, John, it's been an incredible pleasure. Thank you both so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Sean. And another public thank you from me to John Powell, my collaborator and kind of mentor in ways. We're about to get started on movie two, and I look forward to our work together on that.
And also, just always remember this, that Stephen was very kind to supporting my 01 visa. That's why I can say it.
Absolutely.
All those years ago.
Thank goodness we did that.
Well, since we're thanking, I want to thank you guys for The Prince of Egypt, and I'll thank Hans in due course if and when I see him. But that movie, and particularly the music and the songs, came along at a very difficult time in my life, and I found it to be incredibly helpful, and that stuck with me for the last 25 years. So I take this opportunity to thank you both for that.
Thanks.
All right, guys, thank you very much. Awesome. All the best. Thank you. Have a great day.
Yeah. Before you guys go, thank you both for helping to shape Sound of My Childhood in different ways. I just wanted to say that before you both went, because you both had a big impact on me musically, and it's a real privilege, as it is with John as well, to be able to speak to you both. So, yeah.
Thanks, Sean.
Yeah. When it was announced that we were actually going to speak to you, I actually swore to you, John.
You did. Yes. Yeah, he did. Swear. Yes, he did. He used curse words. Yep.
Yeah. But yeah, thank you both.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks so much, guys.
Have an incredible day, guys. Thank you very much. Thanks. Bye.
Bye bye.
All aboard the Emerald City!
Just follow the road.
It's going to lead you right
to me.
The best way to bring folks together is to give them a real good enemy.
This wicked witch.
Don't be afraid. It's the wizard who should be afraid of me.
The wizard that there is or was is ever gonna bring me
down. John Powell and Stephen Schwartz there discussing their recent work on the soundtrack to Wicked. My thanks to them, also to Sean Wilson, and thank you for listening. Wicked is in cinemas and theatres now across the world. You can, of course, see it via our friends at View Cinemas, myview.com, to find a view near you and get details on times and tickets. That being said, if you would prefer to watch from the comfort of your own home, as we mentioned before, Universal Pictures Home Entertainment have just this weekend released the film to watch on your sofa via digital rental and buy and keep. So be sure to check it out via your preferred digital download provider too. Both soundtrack albums are out now, including a compilation featuring music from John and Stephen, and with songs written by Stephen for Wicked the movie. That's available via Republic Records, as is a score album from John, available now too via Backlot Music. To get more updates from Stephen, you can do so via Wicked Schwartz on Instagram or Stephen Schwartz on Facebook, and John Powell can be found at JohnJ_Powell on Instagram, at John Powell Music on X, and John Powell on Facebook. To keep up with Scoreheads, I'm at John Brown TV. That's at J-O-N, John Brown TV, on all platforms. Or you can follow Sean on X at Seano22. That's S-E-A-N, so at Seano22. Or Instagram at Sean Filmwriter. Until next time, my score-supporting friend, thank you for listening as always. And don't forget, like, subscribe, share.